Good afternoon. Scott Spears back with you here on this Wednesday, June the 29th, last week of June 2016, 1:14 coming up on 1:15 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and you're tuned into the Now program. I am Scott Spears. We're going to continue our chat this hour with a gentleman who I like a whole lot. He's been on this program before. He is the first African-American Secret Service agent ever, served under President John F. Kennedy. He is Abraham Bolden. His book, The Echo from Dealey Plaza, which you can get on Amazon, and I'm also going to ask Mr. Bolden to tell us if people would like that book personally autographed, how they can go about doing that. But right now, he is seeking a pardon from President Obama. As most of you know, presidents, toward the end of their terms, hand out several pardons for a conviction that he received in his life. Mr. Bolden, glad to have you back here in hour number two.
Yes, glad to be back.
If people do want a personalized copy of the book autographed, how would they do that?
Well, I would suggest that they write me at a.bolden@sbcglobal.net, and I give them all the information that it takes to get an autographed copy.
Perfect. One thing, we were talking about the murder of JFK, the assassination, before we went to break there. And the thing I wanted to ask you, because I say we had Jim Lovell on, who's 95 years old, still alive in Texas, about 2 or 3 months ago. He was the man handcuffed to Lee Harvey Oswald when Jack Ruby shot him. Jim doesn't feel there's a conspiracy, but who do you believe Jack Ruby was?
Well, you know, there's some question about it. We investigated Jack Ruby shortly after Oswald was assassinated. We investigated him in Chicago because of his Chicago ties, and they did associate him with some of the mob element here in Chicago. Now, I wasn't in on that particular investigation, but he was definitely identified by those who were in the office investigating the Chicago connection as having some relationship with the mob here in Chicago. And that's about the extent that I know concerning Jack Ruby. All the rest that I know about him, I've read but from other researchers.
When you were around, did Lee Harvey Oswald ever show up anywhere? Was he ever on a watch list? Did you have any idea who he was before that day in Dallas?
No, I didn't. But I will tell you this. In March of 1963, the president was coming to Chicago. And we got a mysterious telephone call at the Chicago office of the Secret Service. We happened to be sitting there at a meeting. And the call came in from the FBI. And the FBI said that they had received a call from some guy named Lee saying that there would be an attempt to assassinate the president on the way from the airport in a motorcade. Now, this call came in from the FBI, and we were, as I said, happened to be in a meeting. We were discussing the president's visit coming to Chicago. This information was relayed to us through the FBI. Mr. Martineau, who was the special agent in charge at that particular time, told a group of agents who were sitting there, some nut named Lee just called and said that the president was going to be assassinated as he comes in a motorcade from O'Hare Airport. Now, in order to abort that situation that was developing, the president was flown in to Meigs Field by helicopter, so there must have been some truth to that particular charge, because we did change the way that the president was going to come into the hotel, the Blackstone Hotel, where he was going to be living. We landed him at Meigs Field in order to avoid that situation. And so I couldn't... That's the first I heard of a name, Lee, and that's the only name that they gave. Now, what Martineau did, he put the Bob Linsky, who was a lieutenant at that time, Lieutenant Bob Linsky, he called Bob Linsky and told him would they handle the case, make sure that all of the overpasses were staffed, make sure that the vulnerable positions along the what is now the Kennedy Expressway would be covered. But then at the last minute, they changed and said they were going to bring him in by helicopter due to this threat.
Fascinating. Mr. Bolden, there's something I want to talk about here because it's a topic of conversation recently, and you being a past Secret Service agent, I think you'd have a great perspective on this. A book has come out written by a Secret Service agent of Hillary Clinton's in the Clinton White House, saying she did some things, called people names, threw a Bible at somebody. Is that something a Secret Service agent should do while the people he protects or was supposed to protect are still alive and still doing things?
No, actually, I would suggest that the chief of the United States Secret Service, I believe it's Clancy now, review that policy that regarding the agents that are revealing what I deem as subjective information about who they're protecting. I think that book will probably go over the top. Now, why do I say that? It is because all Americans are due some privacy. And I believe that if the Secret Service fulfill their job of protecting the president, that anything that's unrelated to that protective assignment should be confidential and privileged information between the protectee and the protector. I don't believe that the Secret Service has any right to infringe upon the privacy of civilians who that they're protecting, whether it be the Pope, whether it be the Secretary of State or the President or the First Lady. I believe that certain things are off limits, certain private conversations are off limits, and I believe that the Secret Service, the first order of business should be to make sure that there's an understanding that agents are not there for the purpose of researching a book are exercising First Amendment rights, but they're there to carry out an assignment just as if anybody were working for any corporation. It is not their business, if they're a secretary, to write a book about who their boss is saying that's his private life or where he's going or what appointments that he makes. They're to carry out their assignment, stick to the business that the Congress has appointed the Secret Service to do, and be very careful about what they say, because they have to understand that what they report can change the course of history. It can affect elections, it can affect people's attitude towards the individual and his qualifications to hold office that he is seeking.
Not that you would ever reveal anything like this, but were there because basically the gist of this book, as I understand it, is not that she did anything criminal. It's just that she had a bad attitude, that she wasn't a very nice person, didn't treat people very nicely. When you were in the White House, when you were protecting a president, are there things that you could have talked about or could talk about or write about if you wanted to that would make the president or the first lady or somebody, vice president, seem like a mean person?
Absolutely. Yeah. That certainly is. There certainly is, and I can't go into much detail about it, but when I was guarding the Oval Office under President Kennedy, I heard some conversations that were going on, very loud conversations and arguments that he had with certain people, and I heard certain people make threats towards the president right inside the White House. So I don't want to go into that because, as I said, it's a possibility that that could get me eliminated as an individual, and I've suffered enough. But I did overhear some conversations between the president and members of his staff that would probably shock the whole world.
That being said, do you have these things written down anywhere, so if one day, God forbid, something did happen to you, or you just leave this life like we all do at some point, that it would come out?
Well, I tell you, I don't like to infringe on anybody's personal life. I like to try to elevate the good things that they've done. But I just, if it's not positive, such as when I was in the Hannesport, how the president introduced me to members of his family and a few light conversations that we had together. Now, conversations that the president had with other people, I believe, would be off limits, but conversations that he had personally with me is on limits, because this is what transferred between me and him. But if I had seen some evidences of some chicanery or anything, I think that I'm bound by duty to and responsibility and to the dedication of the same privacy that I would want for myself, then I would want for the charge that I'm protecting.
I understand why you don't want to reveal who you think killed the president, but if we're talking in percentages, are you 100% sure, or how sure are you, that you know who murdered President Kennedy if it was not Lee Harvey Oswald?
It's not a question of whether or not I know who murdered the president, because it's the why that's the important issue. Now, once that you solve the why, then the who doesn't matter, because you find out that the who has so many connections in and out with the mob and with the government agencies. President Kennedy was taking action against the CIA. He was trying to change the financial system. He was dealing with certain people who were criminal. And Bobby Kennedy was going after the syndicate. So there's a lot of who's out there. And once that you understand that why that the president was assassinated, and I do understand why the president was assassinated, and that leads me to a who that would be an international operation.
That being said, in all the conspiracy theories that we have heard since 1963, have we ever heard this why or this who?
No.
Never been brought up?
No.
Why do you think that is?
Because it's such international repercussions that it could cause a split in the United States that would be irreparable. It would cause the fall of the United States of America, and it would also cause confusion that would be long-lasting and could possibly cause a revolution within the United States of America. It's just that deep.
Will we?
I have no question whatsoever as to the why the president was assassinated.
But you do think it will come out one day?
Yes, it will come out one day. If I have to bring it out myself before I leave here, I'll do that.
So if something should happen to you, you would this would be coming out?
I believe that if my pardon is not granted, and I'm not trying to threaten anybody or anything like that. I'm not trying to threaten anybody. But I will reveal the why the president was assassinated. and give evidence to that.
So basically, if by June the 20th, 2017, the last day President Obama will be in office, if there's no pardon, the night of June the 20th, or the afternoon, or the next day, you will reveal, if the pardon's not granted, who or why President John F. Kennedy was murdered.
Yes, that's right, and I will document it.
Well, will you come back on this program that day and do it?
Well,
you know, we had to slip that in.
I might have to be with what's his name, Assad, the guy who revealed all the information concerning the wiretaps. What's his name?
Julian Assange.
Yeah, Julian. Yeah, I might have to be where he is.
Well, yeah, hopefully you'll call us from wherever he is.
I don't know if I could do it and stay here or not, but like I said, I'm 81 years old. I'm 81 years old, in poor health. And so I don't have a whole lot to lose now.
But I tell you, it is fascinating, and I hope wherever you are that day, and I think you'll still be with us, that if the pardon's not granted, you'll come and let us know as well. If just by phone. All that being said, final question, what do you make of Donald Trump?
Donald Trump is trying to ride the wave of division that's already here in America. I think he's going to do pretty good in the election. I think that it's going to be a decision that the people have to make, and I believe this thing is going to be so close that, that Donald Trump has a very good chance of sneaking into the presidency of the United States, because I really think that Hillary is going to be in trouble concerning these emails, and that's going to probably knock her out of the running.
If Trump does win, being a man who has met presidents, do you fear that?
Yes, I do.
So you are not a Trump supporter?
No, I'm not a Trump supporter, and right now I'm not a Clinton supporter either. Not at this stage. I haven't quite made up my mind on this. But I think that Trump would be bad for the country. I really do. I think that he would be terrible for the country. I don't think he has enough international experience and diplomacy. You know, it's a different in attitude when you're conducting business and cutthroat business than it is when you're trying to be diplomatic and bring peace and harmony throughout the world. And I don't think that Donald Trump would be the man to make things better for America. I just don't believe that he would. He has the attitude, the demeanor, or the character.
Do you think he's a bigot?
Yes, I think he's a bigot. I think that he's a bigot, and I think that there are more people who are bigots who would like to be able to do and say the things that Donald Trump says, but they're kind of undercover. I think Hillary Clinton's a bigot. I think Bill Clinton's a bigot. I think that we're surrounded by bigots, and that was one of the main reasons of the death of President Kennedy, is that he was not a bigot. And he saw the larger picture, and he saw the picture that that had been ordained from the foundation of the world. And he knew that he had to go. He knew that he was going to be assassinated, as many of the agents will tell you, that he often talked about it.
So he felt that he was going to be assassinated?
Yes. He knew that his life was at stake, and he knew why.
And the why is why he was.
Yes.
And it had something to do with race.
No. It had something to do with something much greater than that.
Bigger than that.
Much more international. Worldly. Yeah, it's worldly power.
Well, I tell you, Mr. Bolden, January 20th, 2017 could be a big day between the possible inauguration of Donald Trump and possibly you telling who what really happened with JFK. That could be a dark day, January 20th, 2017.
Yes, it could if I make it to that, because If I make it to that date, I'm trying. I'm gonna try to hold on here until that date comes.
Well, you keep on keeping
if I
on.
Can, cause, and if I don't, I'm gonna leave something behind.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. Maybe it's simple. Oh, no, I think it's something maybe that we're all entitled to know. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, and I hope we can do it again, and I hope you do get that pardon.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you. Abraham Bolden, thank you so much.
Thanks for the interview.
Again, the book is The Echo from Dealey Plaza. Now, from one extreme to another, holy Moses. Last week we had Clint Hill on. Clint Hill was the Secret Service officer on the back of JFK's limo, November 22nd, 1963. First one on it after the shots were fired that killed the president. We interviewed him last Wednesday. Some of it didn't get on. Here's that interview from where we start talking about President Kennedy. So listen to that. Very fascinating. And if we have some time on the other end, we'll open up the phone lines. Here's Clint Hill. It's here. President Kennedy, you were there during the Cuban Missile Crisis and other things that he faced. What kind of guy was President Kennedy, and what was the Cuban Missile Crisis era like?
Well, the Cuban Missile Crisis was a period of time in the fall of 1962 when we were on the brink of nuclear war with the Soviet Union, they having positioned nuclear weapons and missiles in Cuba, 90 miles from the southern coast of the United States. And history will show that President Kennedy handled it very, very well. Some of the members of the military wanted him to strike a devastating blow to the little island of Cuba. General LeMay specifically wanted him to just bomb them into oblivion. But he decided to have a naval blockade that would prevent the Soviet ships from bringing any more missile material into the Cuban island, and that worked. We were prepared for whatever might happen, whether it would be a launch. If we were given the information that there had been a launch from Cuba, we were prepared to evacuate those people we were protecting, president, vice president, members of their families, to secure shelters, depending upon where we were at the time that we got the word, and which put our families in rather a precarious position because we couldn't tell them what exactly was going on. All we could tell them is what, if you get word of a possible missile launch, just get in the car and head west. That's about the only advice we could give them.
President Kennedy is a human being. What kind of a guy was he?
He was a very personable, down-to-earth man. He knew each one of the agents that worked there by name. He called them by their first name. He would stop and talk to them if given the opportunity when he was going from point A to point B. He was always concerned about their well-being. He knew if you were married or single, if you had children. It was just a very pleasant atmosphere that we worked in during those days. It was very, very nice to be there, and you just had a feeling that you were part of, almost like part of the family, but not quite. We didn't have any social interaction, but other than that, we were pretty close.
Take me back to November 22nd, 1963. What happened that day?
Well, you know, we had been in Texas. We came into Texas on the 21st and gone to San Antonio, Houston, and then Fort Worth, stay overnight. So on the 22nd, we woke up in Fort Worth. And there was a breakfast that morning in a hotel, and then we were going to go over to Dallas, and we were going to fly there on Air Force One, which was something you would not normally do. You normally would drive it so close. But they wanted a photograph of President Mrs. Kennedy coming off the rear of Air Force One in Dallas. And so we flew to Dallas to Love Field, got off the plane. They had their usual reception committee. It was a large crowd at the airport. President saw them, went over and shook hands. Mrs. Kennedy accompanied him. We had flown in special Secret Service motor vehicles to use in the motorcade because it was going to be a slow, open, total exposure motorcade through the streets of Dallas. And so we got them in what was called SS-100X, a Secret Service car. Drove from Love Field down in through the city. Our destination was the Trade Mart, but we had to go through the downtown section of Dallas. They wanted us to go down Main Street. We got there. The crowds were extremely large, 15, 20 deep on both sides of the street. People hanging out of windows, on rooftops, on fire escapes, any place they could be to get a better view of the president and Mrs. Kennedy. They were, for the most part, they were extremely exuberant, boisterous, but very, very friendly. And so we traveled down Main Street, and because the driver of the president's car was keeping the car to the left-hand side of the street, with the president was in the right rear, so that kept the president away from the crowd. But Mrs. Kennedy was in a left rear seat, so she was now right up against the crowd when the driver did this. So I would get up on the back of the car to be as close to her as I could to prevent anything from happening. I did that about four or five times down Main Street, and we got to the end of Main. We had to turn right on Houston and then go left on Elm because we had to get on the Stemmons Freeway to get to the Trade Mart where the president was going to speak. Well, when we went right on Houston and then left on Elm, that put us right in front of a building in Dealey Plaza called the Texas School Book Depository. When we went down Houston, we, the agents on the follow-up car, which is a car immediately behind the presidential vehicle, scanned that building visually, and we saw that there were about three windows open on the side of the building facing the street that we were on, but there was nothing unusual indicated in any of those windows. And so we turned left on Elm. We were going down the street. I was on the left-hand side of the follow-up car. Outside on the running board, I was scanning the area to the left where there was a grassy area with a few people. There was a triple underpass in front of us. I was looking at that to see if it was covered by police, and it was on top on the railroad tracks. And all of a sudden, there was an explosive noise over my right shoulder. I didn't recognize it as a gunshot at first. I thought it was a firecracker. So I turned toward that noise to see if I could identify what it was or where it came from. But as I turned, my eyes had to cross the back of the president's car, and I saw the president make a movement that was very unusual. He grabbed at his throat, and he started to fall to his left. I realized at that point that this had to have been a gunshot, and so I jumped from my position on the follow-up car, running toward the presidential vehicle with the intention of getting up on top of the rear of the car to form a shield or a barrier there to protect both President and Mrs. Kennedy. Just as I approached the car, a third shot rang out, and it hit the president in the head, and it turned out to be the fatal wound. About that time, I started up on the back of the car, and then Mrs. Kennedy came up on the trunk. She was trying to grasp some of the material that had come off the president's head when he was hit in the head by this bullet. I grabbed her and put her in the back seat. And when I did that, the president's body fell to its left into her lap. The right side of his face was up. His eyes were fixed. There's a hole in the skull. I could see that most of the brain matter was gone. So I assumed it was a fatal wound. I turned. I gave a thumbs down to the follow-up car crew and screamed at the driver of the presidential car to get us to a hospital, and he accelerated, and we started out, and following the chief of police from Dallas, Chief Curry, he led us to a Parkland hospital at speeds of upwards over 60, sometimes up maybe 80 miles an hour, and I was hanging on for dear life up on top of the back of the car so that nothing further could happen to either President or Mrs. Kennedy.
Clint, in that famous interview with Mike Wallace in the 1970s, you said that the monkey that was on your back was that if you had reacted a few seconds earlier, you believe maybe that wouldn't have happened. What do you believe now?
Well, I could not have reacted much faster than I actually did. I now understand that. That I reacted right after the first shot was fired. As soon as I visually realized what had happened, I reacted. I would have had to have reacted quicker in order to get there to take that third shot, but that's what I should have been able to do. That was my job, to be up there and to form that shield and be the recipient of the bullet, not the president. We were there to protect him, and we failed to do so on that day.
That being said, when you recount that and say that today, what emotions do you have?
Well, I still feel that sense of failure and that sense of guilt somewhat, that we were not able to fulfill our responsibility, which was to protect the president. I realize after having gone back to Dealey Plaza and looking at the area that I did everything I could that day, circumstances, the time frame, everything else, and the fact that all the advantages had gone to the shooter that day, we didn't have any. And so that's somewhat helpful to me, but it still doesn't erase completely that sense of failure and guilt.
So many people, this has become the head conspiracy theory story of our time. A lot of people say, why was there no top when he wasn't very well liked in Texas? Why weren't the Secret Service closer? What did happen? Why was a situation created that could happen?
Well, first of all, using that car, 100X, the president had issued a decree earlier in the administration, he used that car, and it was going to be used for a parade situation like this. The top would be off. There were only two circumstances when the top would be on. If it were raining, or if the wind was blowing enough and Mrs. Kennedy was with him, and it would mess up her hair, then you could have the top on. But neither of those two things existed on this day. Secondly, this trip was for maximum exposure. That's the reason they went to Texas, was to allow all these people, all these Texans, to view them, get that sense that they were close to the president. That's why he did not want us up on top of the car with him. He felt that that was a sign that there was a barrier between himself and the people, and he didn't want that to be the case. He told us at one point that when we hovered over him, the people have that feeling there's a barrier, that he said that he couldn't get elected dog catcher unless he had that exposure and that feeling with the people that he was one of them.
Do you believe that it was Lee Harvey Oswald and Lee Harvey Oswald alone?
Yes, I have no, there's nothing else to indicate to me that there was anybody else involved other than Lee Harvey Oswald. He acted alone. He fired three shots. They were the only three shots fired that day. And that's what happened in Dealey Plaza on November 22nd, 1963.
Why is it so hard for people to believe that? What is the definitive evidence in your mind that says he was the guy and was acting alone?
Well, you know, the reason that most people can't believe, they can't believe one person acting alone can do this. But they forget that if you go back in history, and recent history even, the type of individual that Lee Harvey Oswald was the same type of individual who tried to kill a congresswoman from Arizona down in Arizona. Nobody knew about him prior to the event occurring. He's what we call a lone wolf, and he shot and almost killed her. It's the same type of individual who tried to kill Ronald Reagan. It's the same type of individual who tried to kill George Wallace in Maryland. I mean, it can go way back as far as you want to go, and in almost every case, it's one individual acting alone, unknown to law enforcement as having any grievance against the president, and all of a sudden they act out, and you end up with an assassination.
Why do you think Oswald acted the way he did? That he ran out, shot another cop, gets arrested in a movie theater, says I'm a patsy. Why did Jack Ruby do what he did? I think a lot of that stuff is what adds to the strangeness of the situation.
Well, it does for us too, because we really would love to have interrogated Lee Harvey Oswald to find out what was, why he was doing what he did. and Jack Ruby ended that for us. We didn't have that chance. Ruby acted out, I think, and based on information I've received from police officers who were timed to T, one specifically, who was handcuffed to Lee Harvey Oswald when Oswald got shot by Ruby, told me that he later on was with Ruby, and Ruby told him he really thought he would be a hero by shooting Lee Harvey Oswald. He said, but I guess I really screwed up, and yeah, he did. So,
It's interesting.
Oswald was a real loner. He failed at everything he tried to do. He was trying to gain recognition. Some of the things we don't quite understand is why, for example, he would try and kill General Walker in Dallas, who he tried to kill a month before this, it turns out, and then try and kill, or actually kill, President Kennedy, whose political beliefs are so distant apart from each other. That didn't make much sense, and doesn't even today. But it's a matter of fact that he really was disappointed in the relationship he had with his wife. He was disappointed with the fact that the American people, or the press at least, didn't recognize him for his greatness when he returned to the United States after failing as a defector to the Soviet Union. He was just disappointed in everything that he ever did.
It's interesting because about 2 months ago, we had the police officer who was handcuffed to Lee Harvey Oswald when Jack Ruby shot him, Jim Lavelle.
Yeah, Jim's a very good friend of mine.
Jim, good guy, and he was on here and basically said what you just said, that he doesn't believe there was a conspiracy. But people, so many people in this say that Johnson had something to do with it. Why is that not conceivable?
Well, I just can't believe that that's true, and I'm pretty sure it's not. I'm almost positive it's not. There's no indication that it is. All these conspiracy theories are just what that means, theories. There's no fact involved. It's all theoretical. And so I discount almost each and every one of them. Some of them may have a little more things, some things going for them than others, but basically they're just all what that word means, theoretical.
After President Kennedy was taken to the hospital, what happened? What was your perspective of what was going on?
Well, when we got into Parkland Hospital and got him into the trauma room and in the emergency room, the doctors came from all over the hospital trying to do everything they could to revive him. And it was just futile. There was nothing they could do. They finally realized that. And then at 1 o'clock, they announced that he was dead. But they made a maximum major effort to try and revive him. There's no question about that. There were, at one point, I counted 17 doctors either in and out or around the trauma room. And it wasn't a very big room, so there couldn't be very many of them in there at one time. But everything was done that could possibly have been done to try and revive him.
What were the days after that like for you, for Mrs. Kennedy? What was that like?
Well, it was very difficult. There were two of us who worked with Mrs. Kennedy. Three other agents were working with the children. Everybody else now had gone to the new President Johnson. And so we were working extremely long hours. We had no time to mourn or have any real emotional reaction to what had happened, because we had to concentrate on making sure that Mrs. Kennedy was safe, that the children were safe, and we had to plan for this funeral. Then Mrs. Kennedy wanted to go up to Cape Cod and talk to the president's parents. We went up there on Thanksgiving of 1963, spent a weekend up there with them, then came back to the White House. Then we had to make arrangements for her to move out of the White House. She was given a home to live in by Ambassador Avril Harriman over in Georgetown in a section of Washington, D.C. So we were kept extremely busy. We had no downtime. And then we went to Palm Beach, Florida for she and the children to spend Christmas, which was a regularly scheduled thing. They spent every Christmas, every New Year's, every Easter in Palm Beach. And so she wanted it to be as close to normal as possible for the children. But it was very, very difficult.
Mrs. Kennedy passed away in 1994. When was the last time you spoke with her?
Last time I spoke with her was at Robert Kennedy's funeral in June of 1968.
And what was she like?
You mean at that time or generally?
In generally.
Oh, she was a wonderful lady, much more intelligent than most people realize. She spoke French, Spanish, Italian. She was extremely active, very athletic. She was an expert horsewoman, loved to ride. She loved to water ski, played golf, played tennis, was an excellent swimmer. She was and a lot of fun. She had a wonderful sense of humor. And a very dedicated mother and devoted wife. She really wanted to make sure the children were brought up as unspoiled as possible. I was told that that's impossible since you're always going to be a president, the children of a president, but she wanted it done as much as possible to make sure they were unspoiled.
Why do you think she never did an interview?
Well, she did give an interview to a member of the press. I recall coming back from, we were here in Europe or someplace, from India or someplace, and she did give a written or an interview to a member of the press. But it was very unusual. She didn't think it was her place really to do that. She wanted to stay out of the public eye as much as possible. She was quite a private lady. She really wanted her privacy as much as possible. That's why we spent so much time either in New York or out in Middleburg, Virginia, in the Hunt Country, at a place that they had leased out there to enable her to ride and enjoy the private life there in the countryside. She was away from the public eye, and that's what she really enjoyed most.
You know, it's interesting because so many things happened with the Kennedys that there has been this curse idea. When you saw her at Robert Kennedy's funeral, what had she changed from her days in the White House?
Well, at that time she was so sad because now another one of the Kennedy family had been killed, and she was close to Robert Kennedy. They were sister-in-law and brother-in-law, and so she was very close, and it was really devastating to her. She really lost confidence in anybody being able to keep her secure from that point on as well. And it wasn't too many months later that she ended up marrying Aristotle Onassis, and I've always thought that one of the major reasons was that he had his own villa on an island, he had his own aircraft company, he had a place to live in Paris, he had a place to live in New York City. She could really almost disappear into the woodwork if she wanted, she and the children, because he had all those resources. And I think that was, in my opinion, a major reason for her to marry him.
Real quick here, and we kind of glazed over this, but the Nixon White House had a Secret Service agent enlisting you to assign a specific Secret Service agent to Senator Edward Kennedy. What was that all about?
Well, it became obvious to me because I was the one that got the call from the White House, from Alex Butterfield, who was presidential assistant, telling me that they wanted to have assigned a specific agent to Senator Edward Kennedy. And that was very, very unusual. That never had happened before, where someone had designated somebody to be assigned to a protective unit. So it was obvious to me that what they wanted to do was insert somebody into the protective unit that they felt would provide them with information. I, at the time, told Butterfield that we had the people in place and that wasn't necessary. But then I got another call from one of the assistant secretaries of the Treasury, who we were part of the Treasury at the time, telling me that that was going to be done whether I liked it or not. And so we contacted the agent that was involved. I had him contacted by his superiors in the investigation part of the Secret Service, and they laid the law down to him about what he could and couldn't do. And the next day he called back in. He said, well, Clint was right. They're already trying to get me to give them information. And so it was a matter that they wanted to insert an agent as an informant in a protective detail assigned to Senator Kennedy.
And that is all the time we have today. What an interesting hour. Stay tuned to WWGH Radio for much more information. Remember, you can always email me, Scott, at WWGH1071.com, and check out the free TuneIn app on any mobile device. Just search WWGH. For this day, very interestingly, Scott Spears heading for the dugout. Stay tuned to WWGH Radio. You're listening to WWGH Radio 107.1 FM, Marion, Ohio, the talking place for legendary comedian and